Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Stay tuned now for Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer.
What everyone's political views, how everyone analyzes the world, we're in the midst of a period of radical transformation. And the question for all of us is whether it's going to be transformation for the better or transformation for the worse. I mean, what type of transformation? The fact that the world is going to have the roof blown off this century is a given. The change that will take place on the planet in this century is going to, you know, make all other centuries look like child's play.
Today on Tell Somebody, Professor Robert McChesney talks about his new book, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Stand by for Tell Somebody. Welcome to Tell Somebody for January 29th, 2015. www.tellsomebody.us. Follow me on Twitter at Tell Somebody Now. Look for Tell Somebody on Facebook at facebook.com/tellsomebodynow and like it. And remember, you can subscribe to the podcast for free at the iTunes Store. This is your host, Tom Clammer. Robert W. McChesney is my guest today on Tell Somebody. Bob McChesney was in Kansas City last spring speaking about the latest book he co-authored with John Nichols, Dollarocracy, and he's been a frequent guest on this show since it started in 2005. McChesney is the Gutzel Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois. He is author, co-author, or editor of many books, including Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. Noam Chomsky has said that McChesney's work has been of extraordinary importance. It should be read with care and concern by people who care about freedom and basic rights. McChesney has a new book out, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, Media, Politics, and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy. I got on the phone with him a couple of days ago to talk about it. Give a listen. Robert McChesney, welcome back to Tell Somebody.
Great to be here, Tom.
Your new book, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, Media, Politics, and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy. Tell me about the title, how you came up with that.
Well, it was really difficult to come up with a title, and I was tossing ideas around with friends and my publisher, Monthly Review Press, because the book is a collection of 12 essays I've written in the last 5 years. The four of them were written specifically for the book, but the others were essays I'd written, several of them co-authored with friends like John Bellamy Foster. And, you know, they're all related about politics and understanding what's going on. But it's hard when you have a book like that to come up with a coherent title. And ultimately, I came up with the title Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century because the book is really about ways of understanding the crisis we're in and how it's heading, and that no matter what, whatever one's political views, how everyone analyzes the world, we're in the midst of a period of radical transformation. And the question for all of us is whether it's going to be transformation for the better or transformation for the worse. I mean, what type of transformation? The fact that the world is going to have the roof blown off this century is a given. The change that will take place on the planet in this century is going to, you know, make all other centuries look like child's play.
And the last part of the subtitle, The Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy, you've compared U.S. media and democracy to countries like Sweden and Norway and Iceland and things like that in the past that are still sort of capitalist. Can we have a democracy with a reformed capitalism, or why do you say post-capitalist?
Well, I think the great tension that I've been writing about for most of my career has been between the way really existing capitalism conflicts with democracy and the principles of democracy. And I use the term really existing capitalism to describe the real world of really existing capitalism. Giant corporations that are semi-monopolistic, that make enormous profits, that own the government, that squeeze workers and consumers and small businesses. And a world in which there's really, as far as I can see, not much future. A world of incredible, unjustifiable inequality, growing poverty, and a dreadful labor market. That's the real world of capitalism. It's a real world of capitalism that, you know, is not conducive to democracy. So we look at the state of American democracy today, and our leading political scientists have done, you know, serious studies of, you know, how decisions are made by the U.S. government. And, you know, it's striking that in the last 3 years we've had several major reports issued on this research, and they all come pretty much to the same identical conclusion, that important decisions, even not important decisions, but any crucial decision that the U.S. government makes, or the federal government makes, and this probably applies to state governments as well, reflects the interests and concerns of the very wealthiest Americans. They're the ones who really have influence and control over what sort of decisions get made. They own the government. And the values, interests, and concerns of the great bulk of the population have no effect whatsoever. In fact, some research shows that you can almost always predict what people will do in Congress because they will do the opposite of what the bottom third of their constituents want. The poorest members, they invariably will do the opposite. So we have a very corrupt, crony, real-world capitalism, unlike the one in the textbooks, and we have a decrepit governing system that is very far from democracy, any definition of the term. And my argument has always been, Tom, that those two things are related. They are not independent of each other. Now, I think that if we're going to get democracy back, we're going to have to change that type of capitalism dramatically. Can it be a reformed capitalism with a place for business and profits and entrepreneurs? Perhaps. I really don't know the answer to that question. I don't think anyone really does. But I do know this. What has to drive the process of determining where we go with our economy is going to be a commitment to democracy first and foremost. We have to establish an economy that supports and enhances democracy and the freedoms that are so important. That's got to be in the driver's seat. Politics first, the economics that is created to support the political values we most cherish. The problem here right now is that the economy is undermining the political values we most cherish. And the way people talk about capitalism and our economy in the mainstream by all our politicians is the fairy tale world of capitalism. It's heroic little entrepreneurs in their garages competing to create jobs and innovate products at lower prices. And it's this sort of heroic fairy tale that has almost nothing to do with the real world of price gouging and ripoffs that most people experience.
In one of the first essays in the book, I think you quote someone writing in the 20s or 30s saying that the crisis of democracy is a crisis of journalism. And I was re-watching an interview you and John Nichols did with Bill Moyers when your Dollarocracy book came out. And Moyers asked you, isn't capitalism itself causing this journalism crisis? And you sort of say, well, I would say capitalism is causing the democracy crisis. It's broader than the journalism crisis. Can you talk about all that a little more?
Well, yeah, thank you. In fact, that's what I was just talking about. The tension, the core tension is between we have an economic system which is dominant in our society, which is not conducive to democracy. At this point, I write about a lot. It can't be overstated. It's really the core tension. And the problem we have today is that our governing system is in the pocket of those who dominate our economy. and we get the results we're getting as a result. And, you know, my interest in journalism and news media is not that I'm just obsessed with journalism and news media per se, although I'm very interested in journalism and news media per se, but I'm mostly interested in them because I think there are institutions that are absolutely necessary. They're cornerstones if we're going to have a self-governing society. Obviously, this is not a radical idea. This country was literally founded on the idea that you needed to have a healthy, independent, vibrant press so that people without property could effectively govern their lives. Governance wouldn't just be done by rich people. That's explicitly what Madison and Jefferson had in mind, as did other framers when they set up the First Amendment and all the great press subsidies that built our press system. So that's not a radical idea. That's a very American idea. But it becomes a very radical idea when you take a look at how our press system and news media are working today, and the state of political information and the state of public participation in governance. Our news media are an abject failure. Our governing system is exceptionally undemocratic, except in name only. And, you know, it all roots back to an economic system that dominates the political system and an economic system that's highly unequal.
But the press, free press, and journalism in America has evolved from ideals and organic process of the free market that it just is the way it is. There's no other choice, right?
You know, it's an interesting history. I've written about this at some length, and I don't want to give a long lecture, but if I was going to make a crude summary of American journalism history, it would go something like this. The first century of American journalism, we had enormous postal and printing subsidies, which spawned a really enormous and impressive free press system with almost no government censorship, except occasionally southern post offices refused to carry abolitionist newspapers. But aside from that, everyone got the subsidies. They got virtual free mail postage, and we had a colossal number of newspapers in America. It was a hallmark of our democracy, especially in the northern states. Then newspaper publishing became very profitable by the end of the 19th and early 20th century. Huge companies came in. The post office no longer distributed papers except for weeklies, but dailies were distributed by their own services, you know, their own systems they set up in their cities. And the great fortunes were built in journalism. Our journalism in both the first initial era and in the great sort of press baron era of Hearst and Scripps and Pulitzer was highly partisan. All the newspapers had very strong political positions. There was no doubt about them. They were expected to be partisan. They were expected to present a strong point of view. And the system worked as long as you had a lot of different points of views available to citizens, not just one. And it was easy to start a new newspaper if you didn't like the existing range. Well, that whole democratic nature of the press system collapsed 100 years ago. And that's when professional journalism came along. Most cities only had one or two newspapers by then. It was impossible to start new ones. The newspapers tended to have very conservative, pro-business politics that were highly controversial in that era. And along comes the idea of professional journalism, that it doesn't matter who owns the monopoly newspapers anymore, because the reporters and editors are professionally trained at universities like the University of Kansas or the University of Missouri, and you can trust what's ever written in one of these newspapers because it reflects the professional judgment of the editors and reporters, not the political agenda of the owners or the advertisers. And that was the era. That's the era we're in now for the last 100 years. In that era, I've written about, lots of other scholars have written about, even at its best, that the type of professional journalism we got in America was deeply flawed. It's not the only type we could have had. There was a huge fight over what professional journalism should be in the 1920s and 30s and into the 40s in American newsrooms. Working reporters and their union, the newspaper guild, many of them, people in the guild and their leaders, people like George Seldes and I.F. Stone, thought that professional journalism should be nonpartisan. It shouldn't take sides. It should hold everyone to the exact same standard, and it should view its job as representing the interests of everyone outside of power versus everyone inside power. That type of professional journalism, which is still practiced today by people like Glenn Greenwald and Amy Goodman, was not popular whatsoever with newspaper owners. And instead we got the kind that that's come to dominate for the last 75 years in the United States, and that most Americans take for granted as the only type of truly professional or democratic journalism. And that type of professional journalism we have tends to allow people in power to set the range of legitimate debate, then it accurately reports on debates among people in power. People outside of power are not treated as seriously or taken as legitimate sources in a debate. And that's why professional journalism, even at its best, tends to share the assumptions of the people who run our country. So the United States, and the United States alone, has a 007 right to invade any country in the world it wants to that no other country has, and we never have to explain it to anyone. Our journalists accept that right because both heads of the Democratic and Republican Party assume that as well. So it's never debated. It's never questioned. And if a professional journalist were to grill a politician on that point, the politician would say, hey, you're not being professional. You're not being objective. You're not being neutral. You've got an axe to grind. You've got an agenda. And that would discipline journalists. That does. They say, hey, yeah, that's really not an issue for me to raise. They're not debating it. I shouldn't be questioning it. So even at its best, professional journalism has had fundamental flaws. The era we're in now, to finish my short lecture, that started really 20, 25 years ago and now is accelerating, is the complete disintegration of the commercial model of journalism. Because journalism in the 20th century, when it was profitable, got most of its money, not just in print and with newspapers or magazines, but also broadcasting, got most of its money from advertising. And advertisers really didn't care about journalism per se. It was simply a commercial decision. That was the best place to get their target audience. Well, in the new era of the Internet, that's no longer necessary. Advertisers can reach their target audience without having to support journalism or pay for any content for that matter. We now know, thanks to Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald, that advertisers, commercial interests, know wherever you are in the web if they want to reach you, and they can buy ads now to get you at whatever website you might be at. And as a result, the amount of money going to support journalism and advertising is plummeting, and the number of working journalists has plummeted. I mean, it's still in free fall collapse as we speak. It's been going on now for about 7 years, and we don't know when it's going to end, but what we do know is there are very few paid journalists today compared to 25 years ago on a per capita basis, and the quality of journalism has suffered appreciably as a result. And this is the crisis we're in now. Professional journalism at its best had its problems, but now we don't even have it at its best. We have it disintegrating and collapsing, and there's nothing on the horizon that's going to do the job of professional journalism or any type of journalism. You know, we can't really afford to have a journalism-free environment and expect any sort of notion of democracy or constitutional rule to survive.
At risk of having you repeat yourself on more current history of journalism and the effect of the Internet, I wonder if I could put out an example that sticks in my mind, if you'll bear with me, and get you to comment on it. You know, and you have talked about how, you know, kind of refuting people who say the Internet will fix everything, among other points, that, you know, you can have all these bloggers saying whatever they want to say, and some of them are pretty good, but basically they're not doing real journalism. This is a guy doing it after work or something, doesn't have the time or resources to do real journalism. And even this show, which I'm very proud of for having guests like you on and Ray McGovern, other national figures, try to cover some local issues, and I think that is of value, but I don't have the time or the resources to do real investigative journalism at all. And a story that sticks in my mind, I think a lot of listeners probably saw a Frontline show called The Warning about Brooksley Bourne trying to regulate derivatives before the financial crisis and being shut down by the likes of Larry Summers and Alan Greenspan. And in hindsight, we can see she's right. And two things that I think this is a real good example of is, one, this kind of story, which I thought they did very well in my ability to judge it at least, takes resources, takes expertise. Not just anybody doing a blog can do that kind of story. The other thing that struck me about it is it came out in 2010, and I don't see any reason why most of it couldn't have come out in time to help avert the crisis rather than picking through what happened afterwards. And is Frontline, is public broadcasting ever going to do that kind of story? Just wanted to get your reaction on those thoughts.
Well, that's a great question, Tom. And, you know, the other great issue where professional journalism is deeply flawed is with how the economy works, in addition to foreign policy. It's very uncomfortable challenging the corporate status quo of the economy, as both political parties and people in power tend to not debate that issue. They accept it. And, on an aside issue, for example, that's why the coverage of trade deals is usually so horrible, because the commanding heights of both political parties are totally on board for giving up labor, environmental, consumer rights, and transferring rights to capitalists and investors who do as they please. And because of that, the press coverage of these trade deals, to such as it exists, tends to be horrible. That's an aside. But that applies fully to the financial crisis, to the collapse of the financial system in 2007 and 2008, and recurring what's happened since then. And, you know, there was the story, you might remember, Tom, I think it was in 2008 or 2009, that the Queen of England assembled a number of the leading economists from Oxford and Cambridge and the London School of Economics, and she said to them, hey, what happened, guys? You're the greatest economists in this country, yet you guys completely were asleep during the financial collapse that's destroying our economy. Your job is to let us know about this. In fact, most of you were saying there's nothing to worry about by this huge buildup of debt and speculation. And she could have really called in a group of journalists the next day and given them the exact same lecture, because America's business and political journalists completely were asleep before 2007 and 2008 and afterwards, really, on the chicanery, the corruption, the rigging, the problems that were involved with the huge growth of debt and the bubbles prior to the crisis, the collapse. And, you know, our economists were fully asleep, but so were our business reporters. In fact, it's appalling to go back and look at sort of the coverage that you see now in the news media of the economic boom prior to the collapse and how they completely were asleep. The real problem here, and why it's a crisis of journalism, is that it's not like there weren't really smart economists saying, hey, we've got a problem here. It's not like there weren't lots of evidence out there to be concerned. It's just that reporters ignored it, avoided it, looked the other way, and took their cues from people at the top, from Alan Greenspan, from that crowd, from Larry Summers, and said, no, basically this is working just fine. We have nothing to worry about. And they left us as a country in much worse shape because they blew the story altogether. This is one of the great problems of our corporate media system. And by corporate, I don't want to assume it's only commercial enterprises. NPR and PBS really are not much better, with the precious exceptions like the ones you referred to. But in their standard day-to-day news reporting, there's really on these sorts of issues no different between them and the New York Times or CBS. So it's a crisis. It's a problem. It's one of the things we do the work we do to get alternative voices out there. Now, I wouldn't say that you don't necessarily do real journalism, or someone who's a volunteer doesn't do real journalism. I mean, that's not for me to make that sort of call. But I think your point, Tom, is right. To have an effective journalism that really works, you need to have people who are paid to do it. You need to have people competing to do it. So if someone misses a story, someone else gets it, and people feel a sense that they better get after it and they don't get complacent. You need to have fact checkers and proofreaders and copy editors. You need to have all sorts of things to really produce a great product. A truly great journalism is a journalism that people in power fear. And today, I don't think many people fear the news media and our political system. They basically just ignore it and bypass it to a large extent. So we have trouble in River City, to use a famous Midwestern expression. And so that book goes into that quite a bit of detail.
Yeah, a couple quotes from your book, a short, pithy one, crappy media coverage matters. And another one, you say, we must begin to organize a revolt against the ruling class imposed ceiling on civilian government spending and social welfare. And that kind of takes me back to the financial crisis. They didn't just blow the story of that crisis. They're not getting it right in the aftermath about what to do about it.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that second quote, because really three of the essays in the book, three of the ones that have a lot of original research, too, that I'm very proud of, that I wrote, co-authored with my good friend John Bellamy Foster, the editor of Monthly Review. Three of the essays really are all about that issue, and I think your listeners will appreciate this. I'll put it in context. You know, when Obama was first elected in 2008, it was just as the financial system was, you know, imploding that fall, and it was clear we were about to go into a deep recession. And I think there were many economists, understandably, said, if we don't play this right, there's a chance this could turn into a Great Depression. This could turn into a decade or generation of severe unemployment. So it's imperative that, you know, the Obama administration come in and act decisively to prevent that, or do what it can to prevent it if it's even capable of preventing it. And so there's a lot of talk around the time of Obama's election in 2008 that we were going to have a new deal, similar to what FDR did in the 1930s with the Great Depression. And by new deal, what that means in effect is the government will take a lot of that money that's not being invested, that's sitting on the sidelines. And even today, we have, you know, well over $1.5 trillion of capital not being invested, just sitting on the sidelines, because investors don't think they can make money by investing it. And but basically, what a new deal means is you take that money, you either borrow it or you tax it, and take it away, and the government then spends it. And it spends it to build stuff, to do stuff, to put people to work, make the economy stronger. Then those people buy products from businesses. Businesses then have more markets, and they invest. They hire jobs, they produce more, and the whole economy takes an upswing. That's more or less the whole New Deal model. And in the process of rejuvenating the economy, you build up your infrastructure. So you have a network of great hospitals or national parks or mass transit. Those are the sort of things you put the money to work. Constructive, necessary, long overdue projects that have been ignored. And I think that's what a lot of us were hoping for from the Obama administration when it came to office. So one of the first one of the chapters in the book I wrote that I'm proudest of, Foster and I wrote in December of 2008, before Obama came to office, and we said, what are the chances that President Obama and his new administration will be able to do something like that, a new deal? And we looked at the American historical record, and what we discovered was that civilian spending by government, federal government especially, but all governments, increased sharply during the 1930s, during the New Deal, to roughly 13% of GDP, of civilian spending, non-military spending. And what we discovered was that after the late 1930s, it pretty much stayed at 13% thereafter to the present day. I mean, it's fluctuated slightly, but it's pretty much been locked in, civilian government spending at 13%. And the other... military spending clearly skyrocketed after that and stayed very high and continued to grow at times. And the thesis, of course, was that when the government wanted to do spending to address economic slowdowns, it was much easier to raise military spending than any other form of spending. So in American politics, that was the pump that was primed, because there's powerful lobbies that benefit by military spending, and there are no powerful lobbies that are penalized by military spending. So that's the one that always gets touched up. Whereas civilian spending, if it's building hospitals or schools or mass transit, there's usually some powerful domestic lobby that opposes it for one reason or another. So we said, can Obama raise that level above 13%? Can he actually raise it to 18 or 20? And in the piece, we talk about what civilian spending is in countries in Europe, Germany, France, Sweden, Norway, and it's significantly higher. You know, it's, I don't have the figures in front of me, but it's, you know, it's not like 2 points higher. It's like double, 2.5 times higher. Could Obama do that? Could he build the world's greatest mass transit system so that we could reduce our dependence on automobiles and make it much easier to get around the country? Could he have the sort of high-speed rail that's common now in Europe and China instead of these duffer trains we've got in this country on rails that are 100 years old? You know, we could have done that. Is it possible? And we concluded, no, it's not, probably not going to happen for political reasons, because it would take the Obama administration willing to go out and organize popular protests to force this through, greater than the popular organizing it took to get him elected in the first place. And we didn't sense that was his comfort zone. And in fact, that isn't his comfort zone, and he did not forcibly do a great deal of spending to really give us a new deal. We didn't get one. But there was a second part of that, if you'll bear with me, Tom, that's worth noting. It was interesting to us that 13% figure of spending, civilian spending by government, remained true even in the 80s, 90s, and zeros, because you know, we've all lived through the so-called era of neoliberalism, when there have been all these cutbacks in social programs by state and local and the federal government in the last 30 or 40 years. So you would expect then that civilian spending would go down compared to the 1960s or 70s, when all the liberals were running things, and it was a high water point for civilian spending. How could it be, we asked, that it stayed constant if you've had this sort of conservative reaction and all these cutbacks for the last 35 or 40 years? And the answer to that is that what happened is that those cutbacks did take place, but they were replaced by prison spending, which is considered civilian spending. So we saw all over the place huge increases in prison spending, penitentiaries as a big part, especially state government spending, but also federal, but especially state, and a decline in social spending as part of the civilian component. And that explains why it's remained constant. Because the nature of the contents of civilian spending has shifted from social spending to penitentiaries and prisons.
And speaking of New Deal, Obama and FDR, I remember shortly after the election seeing cartoons, maybe even one on the cover of Time magazine, I don't remember for sure, of Obama as FDR with the cigarette holder and the grin, while Obama himself is ostentatiously carrying around a biography of Ronald Reagan under his arm. But this is Tom Clammer. You're listening to Tell Somebody. The other voice you're hearing is that of Professor Robert McChesney, and we need to take a break, and we'll be right back after this.
What if we had more hard-hitting journalism, more local stories, more quality kids shows, more independent voices?
What if we had more people telling their friends about the vital information they hear on KKFI? What if we had more listeners supporting community radio in Kansas City and the surrounding area? Most of the nearly 2 million people our 100,000-watt transmitter can reach have never heard of us. What if more people helped us get more hard-hitting journalism and more local stories on the air on KKFI? What if more people realized the potential of KKFI and got involved in trying to reach that potential?
What if we had less celebrity fluff, less mind-numbing advertising, less partisan shouting, less junk TV? We need more public media, better public media, new public media, now.
Welcome back to Tell Somebody. This is Tom Clammer. We're talking to Robert McChesney about his new book, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century. And yeah, one thing that comes to my mind every time we talk about military spending is that, you know, aside from it's just not helping us here at home, as a stimulus, back in World War II, when we shut down the GM plant in Kansas City and started making bombers, that was much more of a stimulus to a faltering economy than military spending is in this modern United States today, yes?
Yeah, I think all the research shows that if the government has ways to spend a dollar to stimulate the economy, military spending at this point is one of the worst ones in terms of creating labor jobs in the United States. For any number of reasons, it's just about the worst one. But you know, the reason why we do it is there are powerful lobbies in this country right now that are constantly pushing for military spending, made up significantly of former generals and admirals who now make seven-figure incomes working for the defense contractors, who are the biggest group of parasites on Earth. They've got a lot of competition, but they're right at the top of the list. And in fact, this gets to the whole point of post-capitalist democracy. What I argue about post-capitalist democracy is that the way we should, instead of trying to say, let's create a whole new economy and replace the existing economy by waving a magic wand, one that will be nicer, call it whatever you want, free market capitalism, socialism, cooperatives, I say, you know, that's really not the way we should be thinking about it. Instead, let's look at those areas of our economy now that are clearly anti-democratic and clearly unjustifiable, and let's change those. And I think the first area, Exhibit A, and there's a few others on the list, but the first area would be this whole area of munitions and militarism. You've got to take the profit out of military, profit out of war. And this is a long-standing American tradition that's been completely lost to Americans. You know, the people who started this country were scared to death of militarism and war. That's why our Constitution actually makes it really hard for governments to go to war. We ignore those stipulations now, but we used to take them seriously. And into the 20th century, whenever we built up the military for a major war like the Civil War or World War One, almost instantly after the war, the military was decommissioned, set back to really low levels of a military compared to European countries at that time, for example. And it was considered obscene that companies got rich from building weapons. You know, we used to have shipyards that produced all our battleships were government shipyards. Munitions, gun factories, oftentimes were government. You know, they didn't think people should make money doing it. And when people did get rich from war, like during the Civil War, World War One, there were scandals. They were, you know, it was considered an absolute travesty. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt, shortly after Pearl Harbor in December 1941, gave one of his most famous statements. He said, as a result of this war we're in, I don't want to see a single new millionaire made in America. You know, war is not a place people should be making money. This is not proper. And that's right now in America, we have a significant part of our economy is based on, these parasitic corporations that are largely monopolies, sucking the pit of the public treasury, making a fortune and making huge incomes for these former military people for weapon systems we don't need that serve no purpose. But this is where the money is. And it's even gotten worse. Now, in the last 20 years, we've increased what's called outsourcing and contracting out of what used to be traditional functions done by the soldiers in the military. So it used to be, you know, you went in my era, when people went to the Army, they had KP. They had to peel the potatoes. Well, now that's outsourced to a private company, which has a huge markup and does the food for the service, members of the service overseas. So, you know, we've got to take the profit out of it. We should not have huge companies that make money by expanding military spendings and weapons spending just for the sake of their making money. I think we have to nationalize those companies. We have to make it so when we spend money on war, we're spending it because there's a legitimate national security thing that the people debate, discuss, understand, and buy into. We don't do it simply because the world's best lobbyists are pushing members of Congress to do it regardless of any actual legitimate security need.
And speaking of wartime millionaires, besides physical hardware and instruments of war, this brings to my mind, you mentioned Snowden earlier briefly. His revelations kind of sparked a bit of a debate, still not enough, but much more than would have been if he hadn't, about intelligence and spying and so forth. Not near enough, I don't think, of a discussion about outsourcing and privatization of intelligence. Snowden worked for a company called Booz Allen or Booz Allen Hamilton, which gets almost all of its revenues from government contracts. And then you look at some of the upper management of that company, and it's a revolving door with the CIA or the FBI and some of these social media companies. And just, I think there needs to be a huge debate on that. And some of what came up, some of the apologists were saying, well, you know, all these companies know what you have. So that they can help you get a better product, help you do more intelligent shopping, and I like that. Well, personally, I don't, but there ought to be a debate, and there ought to be more knowledge broadly of
how much of this is mixed in with private corporate interests. And Booz Allen Hamilton is owned by the Carlyle Group, which we could do a whole show on that.
Well, your points, I agree with you completely. And the point I'm trying to make is that when you start thinking, if we take all the military production, all the national security stuff, say, okay, we're not going to allow this to be done by private interests to make profit on government contracts. That whole system is riddled with corruption, and it just means that we've locked in the military-industrial complex so it's no longer subject to any political review, which is exactly what we have now. It's not subject to any serious political review. So let's take that. Let's just make those are all going to go back like they used to be in the old days. That's going to be public sector stuff. It's not going to be a profit in creating war spying on Americans. It's going to be done by the government. It's going to be accountable to the people in some fashion, as it is not today. Well, that's a place to start. I think that gets us towards the path of what I would call post-capitalist democracy. Another place, let's talk about all those places are making money by privatizing public services and selling them back to us at higher prices and crappier products. This is pure political corruption. This is crony capitalism 101. It's a sign of a declining economy. The profits come from basically taking existing government services and having private interests take them over and then make a fortune off them by gouging us. Public education, classic example, should not be permitted to let private firms make money. Let me make it clear, private firms make money doing public education not because they're in the private marketplace. They make it because they get public money to operate schools. Be real clear on this. Just like military spending, this is a way to get at the public money, at the public pit. This has nothing to do with satisfying private consumer demand. That's got to go, too. I think you can make a pretty strong case that these energy companies, ExxonMobil, these companies that basically are flame-broiling the earth and pay a fortune to create these phony scientists and PR people to tell us there's no problem with that. We've got to take the profit out of making our species extinct. I think those sort of companies, those monopolies, I don't think we can justify allowing the profit motive to do our energy anymore if that's the result. We've got to nationalize that. We've got to somehow make our energy production outside the hands of monopoly private control by billionaires. I think that's the way I view the economy. I've started several businesses. I've been a small businessman. My brother's a small businessman. I have nothing but respect for someone who starts a business, works their butt off, makes it happen. But what we're talking about here, these are parasites. These are crony capitalists. These are guys who are rigging the system. These guys have to go. They're screwing over everyone. Now, whether we're going to be able to have an economy eventually that's going to be called capitalist or socialist, I don't know. That's why I call it post-capitalist democracy. What's imperative is we have to make it democratic. We have to have our freedoms, our democratic institutions strong and powerful. We have to enhance political participation and debate. And then I'll take my chances with what happens. I think that's the only time I feel comfortable with the sort of decisions are made, when they're made with the consent of the people of the country.
I have lost the exact quote, so tell me if I get the paraphrase wrong, but somewhere in here I think you said something like, the right has understood the critical importance of the media, the left needs to get with it.
Well, I've been saying that for a long time. And, if you go back to the 1970s and the early 80s, but especially the 1970s, there are a handful of seminal documents, and I know you've talked about them, Tom, on your show. The most famous is the Lewis Powell memorandum that he wrote for the Chamber of Commerce, I think, in 1971. But William Simon, the Treasury Secretary for Gerald Ford, wrote a book that was similar. You see that there were a handful of documents that sort of laid out a vision for the corporate right to take the country over after the 70s. And there were a few things that they all agreed on. Number one, you had to get rid of labor unions. You had to reduce their effectiveness. That had to go. Number two, you had to increase military spending, and you had to keep ginning up the sort of hysteria that is conducive to a population that does what it's told because it's scared to death. Number three, you want to minimize popular participation in politics. You want to get people back on the couch, and you want them to think government is bad, it can never solve any problems, it can only do bad things. And number four, among other things, you want to take over the means of ideology. You want to have the news media begin to more aggressively push your particular politics and be less likely to open the door to seeing the world in a different way. So the right wing has taken media very seriously as one of the crucial battlefields they had to win at if they were going to take over the country, take over the direction of the country starting in the late 70s, mid to late 70s. And they were really adamant about how to do it. They started by just criticizing mainstream journalism. Then they went on to creating their own news media that would serve their interests, like Fox News most famously, but most of talk radio. I think the left has not been as prescient. Now, in fairness of the left, it's one thing for the Koch brothers to say we want to do about media when you've got a checking account with $80 billion in it, and all your friends are, also pretty well-heeled, 10-figure net worth. The left has about, as I put it in the book, the left goes into these battles. It's like the left shows up at the Indianapolis 500 on a tricycle and lines up next to all the cars. I mean, it just simply doesn't have the resources to do what the right is doing. But what the left can do is it can organize politically to get policies to blast open the system, to take the media system and create a nonprofit, non-commercial sector that's well-funded, independent, and competitive. You don't really have one nonprofit station in your community. You have several run separately by different people, so they're competing. So you don't have, you don't have to worry about monopoly of control, which is a threat. No matter who's running any media system, you want to avoid monopoly. So they're solvable problems, and I think the left's gotten better at it, but they still, I think, are much more likely to be complacent, to think, well, the New York Times is really on our side. And the media is really, the right wing is explaining that the media are really liberal. We don't have to worry except for that awful Fox News, which is horrible. And I don't think that's really a very good analysis. And you can see where it's gotten us into a very deep ditch.
Well, I wish we had another 20, 30 minutes to talk about the potential of LPFM, among other things. But I know you have to go. But briefly, we do have a pledge drive. Starting tomorrow, and I won't be here, but my show will be in the pledge drive next Thursday. And you write that, it's great to sit around and whine about the media. A much smarter solution is for all those individuals to find their common interests and grounds, understand how the system works, create a system that works to their satisfaction. That's called media reform. Quick final thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, anyone listening to this show shouldn't need to be told that a show like this, a station like this, is not the common diet for anyone who listens to Kansas City radio going up and down the dial. And it costs money to put shows like this on, even though a lot of people who work at the station are volunteers. They're part of the community, and they believe in it, and they want this, they believe in the programming, but there's still bills to be paid, electricity, water, heating, works. You just can't avoid those bills. And it's imperative, if you listen to a station like this, that you give whatever money you can. If you only have a few dollars, give a few dollars. If you're very fortunate and your economic circumstances permit you to give more, give more. If there's someone out there who can give $1,000, write that check for $1,000. And understand, if you write it, there are 1,000 people who can't give more than a dollar who are delighted you're doing it because they wish they were in the position to be able to give that much money. Give whatever you can. These stations are our lifeline to the future. They are the stations that provide different ways of seeing the world, alternatives, ways of seeing the world that you aren't getting elsewhere, and that I dare say time and time again are proven to be the accurate ways when sort of time goes by and you can actually see why did we have a financial crisis? Why was the war in Iraq, in Afghanistan? Why were they such abject failures? Why did what is the basis of the Arab and Israeli struggle? What aren't we learning? Those are the sort of issues you're going to hear here that you aren't going to get elsewhere. And if you want to get that sort of information, you have to pay for it, unfortunately, and you've got to pay for it right now. You've got to call the number you're going to get, make your pledge, and stand behind community radio because, really, it's the cornerstone of the future of this great country.
Robert McChesney, author of the new book, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century. He just told you the first part of the solution. There's much more in the book. I hope you read it. Robert McChesney, thank you very much. Always a great pleasure.
Likewise, Tom. Have a great vacation.
Once again, that was Robert McChesney. and his new book is Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, Media, Politics, and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy. You know, after I hung up the phone, I thought about all the things we didn't get to in his book, things I really would have liked to talk about. For some of those things, there's just not enough time to get to all of them. But also, for instance, this. After I asked him about the title of the book, he said that we're in the midst of a period of radical
transformation. And the question for all of us is whether it's going to be transformation for the better or transformation for the worse. I mean, what type of transformation? The fact that the world is going to have the roof blown off this century is a given. The change that will take place on the planet in this century is going to, you know, make all other centuries look like child's play.
That's a pretty bold statement, I guess, but to me at least, one that's hard to argue with. So I just took that in as a no-brainer and went on with my question about his subtitle reference to post-capitalist democracy. But maybe I should have drawn him out a bit more on that. I think no matter what we do, it's already too late to avoid serious consequences of things like climate change, among many others. Bad consequences are coming. But what are we going to do now to avoid worse things? What do you think? And you know this is connected to climate change and the pledge drive starting tomorrow, right? I want to squeeze in a quote or two from McChesney's Blowing the Roof book before I let you all go. With the disappearance of commercial radio journalism in the United States by the end of the 1990s, NPR stations often became the only game in town. NPR journalism and public affairs programs tend to avoid the salaciousness, idiocy, and asininity of the commercial broadcasting world, which is no small contribution, but stay resolutely within the boundaries of elite debate. They are perpetually in fear of budget cuts driven by the political right with its endless jihad against liberal bias. NPR stations are firmly lodged in a relatively well-established niche of the media system. Community radio stations, on the other hand, have a more fragile basis for existence. There are fewer of them. They largely rely on volunteer labor. They sometimes struggle to find effective management systems. And many of them are one bad pledge drive away from catastrophe. At the same time, the community stations, as a rule, have a much broader range of political ideas. They are the broadcast media that are not constrained by the range of elite debate. Community radio is where one can go to get real criticism of corporate capitalism or U.S. foreign policy, or where one can go to get thorough discussion of the environment, which is impossible with NPR or commercial stations. This is one from the end of the chapter called The State of the Media and Media Reform. He writes, "And those are the sort of problems we're dealing with in media reform. Everyone can sit around and whine about the fact that they don't like all the advertising in media. They don't like the crappy journalism. But they think it's an individual problem. They've just got a problem with the media personally, and then they just try to solve it by finding a website to go to, and they can do their thing. That's really not ultimately a satisfactory solution or a rational solution. A much smarter solution is for all those individuals to find their common interest and ground, understand how the system works, and create a system that works to their satisfaction. That's called media reform." Close quote. You should try media reform, but only if you want to accomplish almost anything else at all in the way of progressive reform. One great way to start would be to call in to this show next Thursday after Democracy Now! And make a donation, as Bob McChesney suggested. Then make plans to come to some KKFI board or committee meetings. Send me an email at mail@tellsomebody.us if you can't find the times and locations posted where they're supposed to be posted. Meetings aren't usually a lot of fun, but sometimes they are necessary, and we need people like you there. And it is, after all, your radio station. Now, I'm going to be taking off 3 weeks of shows to take care of some family business and maybe to see if I can figure a way to keep doing this show that a sane person would have quit a few years ago. But do tune in next Thursday. There'll be a guest host, and after Democracy Now, we'd like your call. Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody, or anytime you like, at www.tellsomebody.us.